Over the centuries since Pedro's senseless death in a fortress far removed from his English home, gold has changed to dollars and pounds and yen and pesos. But we are still killing each other for it. Indeed, this has been going on throughout history. How very little we have learned over the centuries. How much more do we need to suffer before we once again remember about love? Pedro's head began moving from side to side on the chair. He had an amused smile on his face. He had spontaneously entered another, much more recent lifetime. Once Pedro began to remember lifetimes, his visual experiences were particularly vivid. "What are you experiencing?" I asked. "I'm a woman," he observed. "I'm quite beautiful. My hair is long and blonde. My skin is very pale." With large blue eyes and elegant clothes, Pedro was a prostitute much in demand in post-World War I Germany. Although the country was besieged by runaway inflation, the rich still had money for her services. Pedro had some difficulty remembering the name of this elegant woman. "Magda, I believe," he uttered. I did not want to distract him from his visual appraisal. "I'm very successful in this business," Magda said proudly. "I'm a confidant to politicians, military leaders, and very important businessmen." She seemed a bit vain as she remembered even more. "They are all obsessed with my beauty and my skill," she added. "I always know just what to do." Magda possessed an excellent singing voice and often performed at elegant soirees. She learned to manipulate men, probably from all her lifetimes as a man, I thought but did not say. Then Pedro's voice lowered to a whisper. "I influence these people. I can get them to change decisions. They do it for me," she said, impressed with her status and ability to influence these powerful men. "I usually know more than they do," she went on somewhat ruefully. "I teach them about politics." Magda enjoyed power and political intrigue. Her political power, however, was indirect. It always had to be mediated through men, and this frustrated her. In a future life, Pedro would need no intermediaries. One young man in particular stood apart from the rest. "He is more intelligent and serious than the others," Magda observed. "His hair is brown, and his eyes are very blue. He is passionate in everything he does. We spend many hours just talking. I believe we love each other, too." She did not recognize this man as anyone in her current life. Pedro looked sad, and a tear formed in the corner of his left eye. "I left him for another. An older, more powerful and wealthy man who wanted me exclusively. I didn't follow my heart. I made a terrible mistake. He was terribly hurt by my action. He never forgave me. He didn't understand." Magda had sought security and external power, putting these qualities ahead of love, the real source of security and strength. Apparently her decision was one of those that mark a turning point in life, a fork in the road that, once chosen, cannot be undone. Her older lover lost his power as German politics swung wildly to the violent new parties, and he abandoned her. Magda lost track of her passionate younger lover. And finally her body began to deteriorate from a chronic sexual illness, probably syphilis. She was depressed and did not have the will to resist the rampaging disease. "Go to the end of that life," I urged her. "See what happens to you, see who is around. I'm in a cheap bed. In a hospital. This is a hospital for the poor. There are many others there, sick and moaning. The poorest of the poor. This must be a scene from hell. Do you see yourself?" "My body is grotesque," Magda answered. "Are there doctors and nurses around?" "They are there," she answered bitterly. "They pay no attention to me. They are not sad at all. They disapprove of my life and what I have done. They are punishing me." A life of beauty, power, and intrigue had ended on this low note. She floated above her body, finally free. "I feel so peaceful now," she added. "I just want a rest." Pedro was silent in the chair. "We would review that lifetime's lessons another time." He was exhausted, and I awakened him. The chronic pain in Pedro's neck and left shoulder gradually disappeared over the next few weeks. His physicians had never found the origins of this pain. Of course, they had never considered a mortal sword wound from several centuries ago as the likely cause. I am constantly amazed by the short-sightedness of most people. I have many acquaintances who obsess daily about their children's educations, which nursery school is the best, private schools versus public schools, which College Board prep courses are the most effective, how to maximize grades and extracurricular activities to give their children an edge to get into that college, that grad school, ad infinitum. Then the same cycle will start with their grandchildren. But these people think that this world is frozen in time, that the future will be a replica of the present. If we continue to chop down our forests and destroy oxygen sources, what will these children breathe in 20 or 30 years? If we poison our water systems and food cycles, what will they eat? If we blindly continue to overproduce fluorocarbons and other organic wastes and blow holes in the ozone layer, will they be able to live outdoors? If we overheat this planet by some greenhouse effect and the oceans rise and we flood our coasts and overstress oceanic and continental fault lines, where will they live? And the children and grandchildren in China and Africa and Australia and everywhere else are just as vulnerable because they are all inescapably residents of this planet. And consider this. If and when you reincarnate, you will be one of these children. So how can we worry so much about SAT tests and colleges when there may not be a world here for our progeny? Why is everybody so obsessed with living longer? Why squeeze a few more unhappy years out of the geriatric end? Why the preoccupation with cholesterol levels, bran diets, lipid counts, aerobic exercise, and so on? Doesn't it make more sense to live joyously now, to make every day full, to love and be loved, rather than worry so much about your physical health in an unknown future? What if there is no future? What if death is a release into bliss? I am not saying to neglect your body, that it is all right to smoke or to drink excessively or to abuse substances or to be grossly obese. These conditions cause pain, grief, and disability. Just don't worry so much about the future. Find your bliss today. The irony is that, given this attitude and living happily in the present, you probably will live longer anyway. Our bodies and our souls are like cars and their drivers. Always remember that you are the driver, not the car. Don't identify with the vehicle. The emphasis these days on prolonging the duration of our lives, on living to 100 years of age or more, is madness. It's like keeping your old Ford going past 200,000 miles, past 300,000. The body of the car is rusting out, the transmission has been rebuilt 5 times, things are falling off the engine, and yet you refuse to turn it in. Meanwhile, there is a brand new Corvette waiting for you right around the corner. All you have to do is gently step out of the old Ford and slide into the beautiful Corvette. The driver, the soul, never changes. Only the car. And, by the way, I think there might be a Ferrari down the road for you. Chapter 9. As far back as I can remember, I have unconsciously referred to the experiences of a previous state of existence. I have lived in Judea 1800 years ago, but I never knew that there was such a one as Christ among my contemporaries. As the stars looked to me when I was a shepherd in Assyria, they look to me now a New Englander. Henry David Thoreau. 2 weeks had elapsed between Elizabeth's appointments because she had to be away on another business trip. Out-of-town trips were not rare for her. The beautiful smile with which she ended her last session had faded, the realities and pressures of everyday life had once again taken their toll. Yet she was eager to continue the journey back through time. She had begun to recall important events and lessons from other lifetimes. She had experienced a glimmer of happiness and of hope. She wanted more. She rapidly reached a deep trance state. Elizabeth remembered the stones of Jerusalem with their distinctive coloring, which would change according to the light of the day and night. At times golden. At other times a tinge of pink or beige. But the golden color would always return. She remembered her town near Jerusalem with the small dirt and rock roads, the houses, the inhabitants, their clothing, their customs. There were some vineyards and some fig trees, some fields where flax and wheat grew. Water came from the well down the road. Ancient oaks and pomegranate trees were near the well. This was a time in Palestine, as it always seemed to be, of intense religious and spiritual activity, of new changes, always the hope and yet the heaviness, the harshness of the days, of eking out a living, of being oppressed by the invaders from Rome. She remembered her father, named Eli, who worked at home as a potter. Using water from the well, he created shapes from clay, making bowls, jars, and many other items for his home and for the villagers, and even some to sell in Jerusalem. Sometimes merchants or others would come through the village and buy his jugs or cookware or bowls. Elizabeth supplied many more descriptions of the potter's wheel, the rhythm of her father's foot on the wheel, and details of life in this small village. Her name was Miriam, and she was a happy girl living in turbulent times. Soon her life would be forever changed by the spread of that turbulence to her village. We progressed to the next significant event in that lifetime, her father's premature death at the hands of Roman soldiers. The Roman soldiers frequently tormented the early Christians who lived in Palestine at that time. They devised cruel games merely for their own amusement. One of these games accidentally killed Miriam's beloved father. At first the soldiers tied Eli around the ankles and dragged him behind a horse ridden by a soldier. After an endless minute, the horse was stopped. Her father's body was battered, but he had survived the ordeal. His terrified daughter could hear the soldiers howling with laughter. They were not done with him. Two of the Romans then wrapped the free end of the rope around their chests and began prancing around, as if they were horses. Her father lurched forward, his head striking a large rock. He was mortally injured. The soldiers left him in the dusty road. The senselessness of it all added to her piercing anguish, added a bitter anger and hopelessness to her father's violent demise. This was just sport to the soldiers. They had not even known her father. They had not felt his gentle touch as he tended to her minor childhood cuts and bruises. They had not heard his humor as he worked over the wheel. They had not smelled his hair after he bathed. They had not tasted his kisses or felt his hugs. They had not spent every day of their lives with this gentle, caring man. Yet in a few terror-filled minutes they had snuffed out a beautiful life and had filled Miriam's remaining years with a grief that would never quite heal, with a loss that would never be replaced, with a hole that could never be mended. For sport. The senselessness outraged her, and tears of hatred joined those of her pain. She rocked back and forth on the dusty blood-stained ground, her father's large head cradled in her lap. He could no longer speak. Blood trickled from the corner of his mouth. She could hear gurgling in his chest every time he labored to breathe. Death was very close. The light in his eyes approached dusk, the end of his day. "I love you, father," she softly whispered to him, looking sadly into his darkening eyes. "I'll always love you." His dimming eyes looked back and blinked in understanding as they closed for the last time. She kept rocking as the setting sun ended its day. Her family and the other villagers gently took his body from her so that it could be prepared. In her mind she could still see his eyes. She was sure he understood. "As I sat quietly, immobilized by the depth of Elizabeth's despair, I noticed the tape recorder was not running. I put in a new tape, and the red recording light flashed. We were recording again. My Mina connected Elizabeth's current grief to the grief from Palestine nearly 2,000 years ago. Was this another case in which ancient grief was compounding current grief? Would the experience of reincarnation and knowing that there is life after death heal this grief?" I returned my attention to Elizabeth. "Move ahead in time. Go ahead to the next significant event in that life," I instructed. "There is none," she answered. "What do you mean?" "Nothing else happens of significance. I can look ahead. But nothing happens."
"Nothing at all?"
"No, nothing," she repeated patiently.
"Do you marry?"
"No, I don't live very long. I don't care about living. One don't really take care of myself." Her father's death had affected her deeply, apparently leading to a profound depression and an early death. "I have left her body," Elizabeth announced. "What are you experiencing now?"
"I'm floating. I'm floating." Her voice trailed away. Soon she began to speak again, but the words were not hers. Her voice was deeper and very strong. "Elizabeth could do what Catherine and very few of my other patients could do. She could transmit messages and information from the masters, high-level, non-physical beings. My first book is filled with their wisdom. I could perceive similar messages when I meditated, but the words always seemed to be more meaningful when they came from my patients. I knew that I had to develop confidence in my own abilities to hear, to receive, and to perceive these same concepts from these same sources. Remember, the voice said. Remember that you are always loved. You are always protected. And you are never alone. You also are a being of light, of wisdom, of love. And you can never be forgotten. You can never be overlooked or ignored. You are not your body, you are not your brain, not even your mind. You are spirit. All you have to do is to reawaken to the memory, to remember. Spirit has no limits, not the limit of the physical body nor of the reaches of the intellect or the mind. As the vibrational energy of spirit is slowed down so that more dense environments such as your three-dimensional plane can be experienced, the effect is for spirit to be crystallized and transformed into denser and denser bodies. The densest of all is the physical state, the vibrational rate is the slowest. Time appears faster in this state because it is inversely related to the vibrational rate. As the vibrational rate is increased, time slows down. This is how there can be difficulty in choosing the right body, the right time of re-entry into the physical state. Because of the disparity of time, the opportunity might be missed. There are many levels of consciousness, many vibrational states. It is not important that you know all of these levels. The first level of the seven is that which is most important to you. It is important to experience in the first plane rather than to abstract and intellectualize about the higher planes. Eventually you will have to experience them all. Your task is to teach of experience, to take that which is belief and faith and transform it into experience so that the learning is complete, because experience transcends belief. Teach them to experience. Remove their fear. Teach them to love and to help one another. This involves the free will of others. But to reach out with love, to reach out with compassion, to help others, this is what you must do on your plane. Humans always think of themselves as the only beings. This is not the case. There are many worlds and many dimensions. Many, many more souls than there are physical containers. Also, the soul may split if it wishes and have more than one experience at the same time. This is possible but requires a level of development which most have not achieved. Eventually they will see that like a pyramid there is only one soul, and all experience is shared simultaneously. But this is not for now. When you look into the eyes of another, any other, and you see your own soul looking back at you, then you will know that you have reached another level of consciousness. In this sense reincarnation does not exist, for all lives and all experiences are simultaneous. But, in the three-dimensional world, reincarnation is as real as time or as a mountain or as the oceans. It is an energy like other energies, and its reality depends on the energy of the perceiver. As long as the perceiver perceives a physical body and solid objects, reincarnation is real to that perceiver. The energy consists of light and love and knowledge. The application of this knowledge in a loving way is wisdom. There is currently a great lack of wisdom on your plane. Elizabeth stopped speaking. Like Catherine, she could remember the details of her physical lifetimes but nothing of the messages she delivered from the in-between lifetimes state. Both were in much deeper levels when transmitting these messages. Very few patients go so deep that amnesia is induced. Like Catherine, Elizabeth's messages could help to correct the lack of wisdom on our plane. We would harvest much more knowledge before Elizabeth was through. My contact with the wisdom of the masters has been limited since Catherine was cured and her therapy ended. Yet in an occasional, unbelievably vivid, nearly lucid dream I will receive more information, such as the lectures near the end of many lives, many masters. And sometimes the messages come when I am in a deeply meditative dreamlike state. For example, a system of psychotherapy for the 21st century was laid out for me. A system that is psycho-spiritual in nature and which could supplant the tired techniques of the past. The messages and images crowded my brain at great speed with a flitting, brilliant clarity. Unfortunately, I could not tape record my mind, the receiving station. So the ideas are like precious stones, but the setting my words trying to explain and define the speeding, darting thoughts is like dross. The beginning was a clear message. All is love. All is love. With love comes understanding. With understanding comes patience. And then time stops. And everything is now. Instantly I comprehended the truth of these thoughts. Reality is the present. Dwelling in the past or future causes pain and illness. Patience can stop time. God's love is everything. I could also immediately comprehend the healing power of these thoughts. I began to understand. Love is the ultimate answer. Love is not an abstraction but an actual energy, or spectrum of energies, which you can create and maintain in your being. Just be loving. You are beginning to touch God within yourself. Feel loving. Express your love. Love dissolves fear. You cannot be afraid when you are feeling love. Since everything is energy, and love encompasses all energies, all is love. This is a strong clue to the nature of God. When you are loving and unafraid, you can forgive. You can forgive others, and you can forgive yourself. You begin to see with the proper perspective. Guilt and anger are reflections of the same fear. Guilt is a subtle anger directed inward. Forgiveness dissolves guilt and anger. They are unnecessary, damaging emotions. Forgive. This is an act of love. Pride can get in the way of forgiving. Pride is one manifestation of ego. Ego is the transient, false self. You are not your body. You are not your brain. You are not your ego. You are greater than all of these. You need your ego to survive in the three-dimensional world, but you need only that part of the ego which processes information. The rest, pride, arrogance, defensiveness, fear, is worse than useless. The rest of the ego separates you from wisdom, joy, and God. You must transcend your ego and find your true self. The true self is the permanent, deepest part of you. It is wise, loving, safe, and joyful. Intellect is important in the three-dimensional world, but intuition is more important. You have reversed reality and illusion. Reality is the recognition of your immortality, divinity, and timelessness. Illusion is your transient three-dimensional world. This reversal is damaging to you. You yearn for the illusion of security instead of the security of wisdom and love. You yearn to be accepted when, in reality, you can never be rejected. Ego creates illusion and hides truth. Ego must be dissolved, then truth can be seen. With love and understanding comes the perspective of infinite patience. What is your hurry? There is no time anyway. It only feels that way to you. When you are not experiencing the present, when you are absorbed in the past or worried about the future, you bring great heartache and grief to yourself. Time is an illusion, too. Even in the three-dimensional world, future is only a system of probabilities. Why do you worry so? Therapy can be done to the self-understanding is therapy. Love is the ultimate therapy. Therapists, teachers, and gurus can help, but only for a limited time. The direction is inward, and sooner or later the inward path must be trod alone. Although in reality you are never alone. Measure time, if you must, in lessons learned, not in minutes or hours or years. You can cure yourself in 5 minutes if you come to the proper understanding. Or in 50 years. It is all the same thing. The past must be remembered and then forgotten. Let it go. This is true for childhood traumas and past life traumas. But this is also true for attitudes, misconceptions, belief systems drummed into you, for all old thoughts. Indeed, for all thoughts. How can you see freshly and clearly with all those thoughts? What if you needed to learn something new? With a fresh perspective? Thoughts create the illusion of separateness and difference. Ego perpetuates this illusion. And this illusion creates fear, anxiety, and tremendous grief. Fear, anxiety, and grief in turn create anger and violence. How can peace exist in the world when these chaotic emotions predominate? Just unravel. Go back to the source of the problem. You are back to thoughts, old thoughts. Stop thinking. Instead, use your intuitive wisdom to experience love again. Meditate. See that everything is interconnected and interdependent. See the unity, not the differences. See your true self. See God. Meditation and visualization will help you stop thinking so much and will help you begin the journey back. Healing will occur. You will begin to use your unused mind. You will see. You will understand. And you will grow wise. Then there will be peace. You have a relationship with yourself as well as with others. And you have lived in many bodies and in many times. So ask your present self why it is so fearful. Why are you afraid to take reasonable risks? Are you afraid of your reputation, afraid of what others think? These fears are conditioned from childhood or before. Ask yourself these questions: what's to lose? What is the worst that can happen? Am I content to live the rest of my life this way? Against a background of death, is this so risky? In your growth, do not be afraid of evoking anger in other people. Anger is only a manifestation of their insecurity. But fearing this anger can hold you back. Anger would be merely stupid if it didn't create so much grief. Dissolve your own anger in love and forgiveness. Do not let depression or anxiety hold you back in your growth. Depression is losing perspective, forgetting, and taking things for granted. Sharpen your focus. Reset your values. Remember what should not be taken for granted. Shift your perspective, and remember what is important and what is less important. Get out of the rut. Remember to hope. Anxiety is being lost in the ego. It is losing one's boundaries. There is a dimly remembered loss of love, a wounding of pride, a loss of patience and peace. Remember, you are never alone. Never lose the courage to take risks. You are immortal. You can never be hurt. Sometimes the messages are much less psychological and seem to be from an older, more didactic source. The style is quite different. It is almost as if I am taking dictation. There are many types of karma, debts to be balanced. Individual karma pertains to the entity's own obligations, those unique to him. But there is also group karma, the collective debts of his group, and there are many groups, religions, races, nationalities, and so on. At a larger level, there is planetary karma, which will in time affect the planet's destiny and outcome. In group karma, not only are individual debts accumulated and worked through, but the outcome is eventually applied to the group, country, or planet. The application of such group karma determines the future of the group or country. But it also applies to the reincarnating individual, both within the group or country, or simultaneously and intersecting but not within, or at a later point in time. Action becomes right action when it becomes action along the way, along the path toward God. All other paths are eventually blind alleys or illusions, and action along those paths is not right action. Thus right action promotes the individual's spirituality and his return. Action that fosters justice and mercy and love and wisdom and the attributes we call godly or spiritual is inevitably right action. The fruit of right action is the desired goal. The fruits of actions along the other paths are transient, illusory, and false. These fruits entrap and deceive, but they are not what we really desire. The fruits of right action encompass all our goals and wishes and all that we need or desire. Fame is an example. He that seeks fame as an end in itself may achieve fame for a while, but that fame will be temporary and will not gratify. If, however, fame comes to one unbidden, as a result of right action, action along the path, that fame will endure and will be proper. But to the person on the path, it will not matter. This is the difference between fame sought selfishly, for the individual, and fame unsought and not desired, a byproduct of right action. The first is illusion and is impermanent. The second is real and permanent, adhering to the soul. The first accrues karma and must be balanced, the second does not. Sometimes the messages flash by very quickly and succinctly. The goal is not to win but to open up. Then, as if his, her turn came again, more from the psychological source and the rapid-fire impressions. God forgives. But you also have to be forgiven by people. And you have to forgive them. Forgiveness is also your responsibility. You must forgive and be forgiven. Psychoanalysis does not repair the damage. You still have to go beyond understanding and make changes, improve the world, repair relationships, forgive others and accept their forgiveness. Being active in seeking virtue is of the utmost importance. Lip service is not enough. Intellectual understanding without applying the remedy is not enough. Expressing your love is,